I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Khalil Nasrallah, co-founder of Wadi Foods, a natural food company located in Egypt. Wadi Foods was created with the goal of providing high-quality, healthy food products to the Middle East. In 1996, Wadi Foods started out as an olive oil producer with a farm of 80 acres outside of Alexandria. Wadi Foods now has close to 5,000 acres and revenues of $20 million. Products include olive oil, pasta, sauces, natural bee honey, capers, balsamic vinegar, and pickled vegetables. Wadi Foods is the first company of its kind to offer high-quality foods at affordable prices to Egyptian consumers. Welcome, Khalil.
Thank you, Jessica.
Now, Khalil, you're originally from Lebanon. How did your family end up in Egypt?
Well, it was actually my father who decided to move to Egypt after he lost his business in Lebanon during the war. And he used to be in the poultry operation, poultry business. And he looked into the Middle East for another possibility to start a new venture. And at the time, Egypt was not very developed in poultry operations. And he partnered with our partners, and they started the business of raising chickens and producing baby chicks, basically, in Egypt in 1984.
You mentioned that he left during the war. This is the Lebanese Civil War, and your family went to Egypt, and you instead went to Canada to get a master's in horticulture. Before you went to Canada, you were in Beirut during the Civil War, going to school. Talk to me about what it was like on a daily basis.
Well, on a daily basis, you kind of get adjusted to a dangerous situation. It's a very strange feeling when you're in it. You kind of know where to go and how to avoid to be in danger. But we were in situations that were very much life threatening. I mean, we were our apartment was attacked quite a few times, and in 1982, during the Israeli invasion, our apartment got bombed and burned completely.
When you say your father lost his business, lost the poultry business, what does that mean? Did it just get bombed, or?
The business actually got damaged in different ways. One of them was bombed, yes. It was looted, so he could not distribute the chickens anymore. You know, the products to the market anymore. So because of the trucks being stolen. Then the farms were far from the office. The office was in Beirut, and the farms were in the Bekaa Valley. And to reach the Bekaa Valley was actually quite a challenge, because you had to go through quite dangerous, war zones, basically.
It's one thing for a 20-year-old to pick up and start a new life, but your father was almost 60 when he picked up the family and moved to Egypt. Do you remember any anecdotes, or do you remember the way he felt or how he was during that episode?
Well, it's hard to remember how he was, but I do remember admiring him, you know, at 60 to move to Egypt and start a new venture from scratch. And actually, he did like a feasibility study at that age. You know, imagine, I can't even imagine doing it myself. But I remember that, he is a very fun, loving person. And I remember during these times, he was not much fun. I mean, he was nervous. He was, I could feel it. Everyone in the family could feel that this was getting to him.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Khalil Nasrallah, co-founder of Wadi Foods, a natural foods company located in Egypt. Wadi Foods was created with the goal of providing high-quality, healthy food products to the Middle East. You decided, after graduating from the American University of Beirut, to go to get a master's in Canada in horticulture. Did you have any idea while you were in Canada that you would one day join the family business in Egypt?
No, not really. I mean, doing horticulture was something I loved, and I really thought I was going to stay in Canada for a long time. I mean, I had had enough of Lebanon, and I wanted to be out of there. I mean, basically, I was very bitter getting out of Lebanon. It was enough. So the thought of moving back and living in Egypt and working with my family was far from what I was thinking. And eventually I did that because when I graduated from the university in Canada, I could not find a decent job in 89. There was a recession happening in Canada, so I decided to look for another place to find a job. And my father told me to move to Egypt if I wanted to.
So you went back to Egypt in 1990, joined the family business. Why did you decide on olives or olive oil versus other plants or crops that you could have produced in the desert?
Before I even got there, they had already planted a small area with olive trees and other crops. And the olive trees were thriving while the other trees or crops were really suffering from the lack of water and the heat. And for another reason as well, because we were a poultry operation, olives don't really attract birds, which bring in diseases to the poultry, to the chickens. So because it's a bitter fruit, and birds don't like to eat bitter fruits. So it was another reason why olive trees were a good idea. It was a good synergy between growing olive trees and raising chickens on the same farm.
Can you explain what role the government had to play in the production of your crops?
The government has, or there is a law in Egypt that will allow you to purchase desert land if you reclaim it. And by reclaiming it, it means you have to plant it within a 3-year period during which you are monitored by the government. And after 3 years, the government will come in and will check whether you have actually planted seriously or not, and will give you the final purchasing deeds, you know, to the land. But otherwise, it was very difficult dealing with the government because you have to go through so many permits before you even reach that point. One of them, actually, one of these permits is to have the right to dig wells, because you're in the middle of the desert and you need to dig deep wells to reach the water aquifers. And they don't give you a permit because they simply tell you there is no water in the desert. And at the time, we were stuck in the middle of, you know, trying to figure out how to deal with this new project and not able to dig wells. And we decided that in the end to just risk it. So we risked it. We spent a lot of money digging these wells. And we've been using this water ever since. It's been 20 years, 20 plus years now, and we don't have any problem finding this water. So
yeah. Illegally, you dug these wells to get the water, even though you didn't have the permit. Did you retroactively, or did you eventually get the permit from the government?
No, we still don't have a permit. We're still, in a way, illegal, yes. One of the permits that we have to get in order to develop desert land is a permit from the Higher Antiquities Authority in Egypt. And we are in the middle of the desert, remember, so we are really far from any civilization there. But so we had a visit from the authority, and they came to the land, and they decided that there could be some pharaonic or antiquities there in the land. So they requested that we sponsor or we finance a dig up.
Like an archaeological
dig in the middle of the desert. And so our land for almost a week was subject to digging 1 meter by 1 meter by 1 meter deep holes looking for pyramids, basically, in the middle of the desert. The land was, yes, it's sandy, but it's not sand. It's not movable sand that would cover monuments. It's just very hard sand. So it's been there for ages. It's been there for thousands of years. It became like rock.
Okay.
So it's like a metallic rock, actually. It's beautiful. And it's in the middle of the desert. So at the time, this must have been a forest or must have been close to water. So this is what we found in this land, and definitely no archaeological sites there.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Khalil Nasrallah, co-founder of Wadi Foods, a natural foods company located in Egypt. Wadi Foods was created with the goal of providing high-quality, healthy food products to the Middle East. So we're talking about the early days of your launching this olive oil company while your brother and father and other partners are working on the poultry business. How developed was the olive oil business in Egypt at the time? What did the industry look like?
When we went to Egypt, my brother and father used to carry in their suitcases food from Lebanon. They used to carry even bread. They used to bring bread from Lebanon. So the food industry in Egypt was probably not developed at all. You had a few companies, yes, some companies making jam, some companies producing bottled water. But in general, if you talk about the food industry, it was very, very young and not developed. So olive oil was definitely not present at all. You had imported olive oil from Greece and from Spain, but you didn't have Egyptian olive oil. And our idea was to come in and to bring in on the shelves a quality olive oil that was similar to European, Italian, or Spanish, or Greek olive oil. And this was the aim of our business.
How were you received by the market initially when you had these bottles of olive oil and you went from store to store asking them to carry your product?
We were very well received because we, from the beginning, we bottled the olive oil in a beautiful Italian shaped, you know, the square bottle, the Marasca. And when we presented this with a beautiful label to the supermarkets or to the hotels, it was received very nicely. Everyone that worked with us or bought from us thought that we were doing the right thing for Egypt and for the consumer in Egypt. And basically, we had to educate the consumer to use extra virgin olive oil because they had the extra virgin olive oil imported, but it was so expensive that it was not easy to purchase by the regular consumer. The main education happened at the level of the hotels and the catering. Mm. We worked very closely with chefs. We invited them to the farm and to the factory, and they visited us, and they gave us immediate feedback, and we did some cooking tests with them, and we went into trade shows inside in Egypt, and we showed people what olive oil is about and how they can consume it. It took a long time, but eventually we now have a normal production of or normal consumption of olive oil in Egypt.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Khalil Nasrallah, co-founder of Wadi Foods. We'll hear more from Khalil coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Khalil Nasrallah, co-founder of Wadi Foods, a natural foods company located in Egypt. Wadi Foods was created with the goal of providing high-quality, healthy food products to the Middle East. In 1996, Wadi Foods started out as an olive oil producer with an 80-acre farm outside of Alexandria. Wadi Foods now has 4,500 acres and revenues of $20 million. Products include olive oil, pasta sauces, natural bee honey, capers, balsamic vinegar, and pickled vegetables. So in the early days, you're accepted well by the consumers, and you're able to get by despite these government impediments by building your own wells. What was harder for you in the early days of launching the company?
I think the hardest part was actually dealing with certain government laws. As a company that's young, we wanted to be innovative. And one of the products that we had created at the time is the fused olive oil. It's olive oil that is flavored with herbs and with spices. And we produced it and we put it on the shelf. And the government actually sued us, basically, for putting this on the shelf without having the proper papers for it.
One might argue that it's good that the government is strict and makes you jump through these hurdles, jump over these hurdles to, you know, get these new products on the shelf because they might not be safe. What is your view on that?
Well, it's good to be strict, yes, but if you really, because we do study the market very closely, and there is, you find in the market olive oils from all over the world now in Egypt. We do analyze these oils, and they come sometimes cheated. I mean, it's olive oil that was mixed with other quality olive oils or with other oils maybe. And this adulteration is not easy to detect, definitely not at the consumer level. And even when they do lab tests, they don't really get the right results. You need a very sophisticated lab to do that. So the government is giving us a hard time selling our products, but they're allowing other products that are imported that are not of the quality of the Egyptian olive oil, and they're allowing them in the market, and they're competing with us, whether on shelf space or price, and this is not totally fair, absolutely.
What was going on with your personal life at the time when you were launching the business? Here you are in a farm outside of Alexandria.
Well, it's when I was alone working on the farm, it was not bad at all. I could spend as many hours as I wanted and sleep at the farm, sleep with the workers and have dinner and lunch with them, whatever. It didn't matter. But in 1994, I got married. And it became an issue. I could not stay at the farm any longer, and I had to be back at home. And at the time, we didn't have cell phones.
At home in Cairo.
At home in Cairo, yes. And we didn't have cell phones to call my wife and tell her I'm stuck in traffic.
Right.
So it was a challenge. I had to balance between work and between being back at home and spending time with my wife and family.
You met your wife in Cairo, and your wife is American.
Yes, my wife is American. She was working as a journalist. She's a journalist. She was working as a freelancer journalist in Cairo, writing for different publications in the U.S. Christian Science Monitor, Business Week, Newsweek. We met at a friend's wedding, but then she decided to move back after a year to the States. And after a year of long distance, we decided to get married, and she moved back to Egypt.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Khalil Nasrallah, co-founder of Wadi Foods, a natural foods company located in Egypt. Now, Wadi Foods is only one company under the auspices of Wadi Holdings, which is a major agribusiness group of companies, 16 companies. There's poultry, food processing, feed manufacturing, glass containers production. So Wadi Foods is just one or two underneath that umbrella. How did that come to be?
Originally, it was only a poultry operation. But little by little, we developed businesses, basically, that were either sprouting from that poultry operation or servicing that poultry operation. For instance, the feed manufacturing is directly serving the poultry operation. The glass manufacturing is directly serving the olive oil, which comes from the olive trees that we planted in the poultry or in the land that we purchased for the poultry farms. I mean, it's a big industry, and it was a big challenge to establish that factory and to run it. And now we are one of the biggest factories in Egypt, producing glass jars and bottles.
Now, Wadi Holdings has revenue of roughly $250 million. Are there any antitrust issues that you have to worry about in Egypt? Like, are you a monopoly in Egypt?
Well, you cannot be a monopoly. By law, you're not allowed to be a monopoly in Egypt. But it's not very closely observed because you still have some monopolies that are functioning in Egypt today. But we are not a monopoly, and we are big, yes, but we don't aim to be the biggest. We aim to be the leaders in our operations.
You've had an entrepreneurial success story, but unfortunately, other than Israel, the Middle East isn't a vibrant community of entrepreneurial activity on a large scale. What do you think accounts for your success in the region?
our success really came from being very close as in a partnership that we've had. We are two families, and we're really close in how we work together. The trust that's between us, the transparency.
And you talk about two families. It's your family, the Nasrallah family, and the
Frazee family.
And you both come from Lebanon.
Yes.
Did you know each other in Lebanon?
Yes, we knew each other. My father knew Moussa Frazee, our chairman, when they both were in the poultry business in Lebanon, and so it was natural for us to almost natural to work together, but we don't have one family, we have two families to deal with, and that was not always very easy.
What are some issues that came up?
In general, in a family business, It's expected of you to accept things the way they are and not argue, because you're one of the family, and you can't really discuss certain issues like your salary or your remunerations or whatever. And that was pretty much what my situation was like. It was tough to deal with that at some point, and because we had an investment with the IFC, the International Finance Corporation. They brought in their values and they brought in their corporate standards, and we had to work very hard on changing that and on incorporating that into our business. And things have changed tremendously since then. And now the two families are functioning as one family. We have a family council. We work very, very in a transparent way. Everything is dealt with. If we are hired, we're hired properly. And if we are fired, we're fired properly. Things have changed quite a bit for us, yes.
Wadi Foods has received loans from the International Finance Corporation, or the IFC. Where else did you get your capital when you were first starting out, for example?
When we first started out, it was our chairman, Moussa Frazee, who was the major shareholder in the company, and most of the capital came from him, probably in few million dollars, a couple of million dollars, something like that. But very quickly, the relationship with the banks, with the local banks, was established, and the local banks were very happy to deal with us, and most of our financing came from them. Until very recently, when we started dealing with some venture capital companies in Egypt and in Lebanon, and with the International Finance Corporation.
Why isn't there more robust entrepreneurial activity in Egypt?
I think in Egypt, what I see in Egypt happening a lot is people like to spend money in something that they are 100% sure will be a good return for them. So you find a lot of import and export businesses happening. Lately you find a lot of retailing taking place of international brands. This is more or less a sure thing, to just start up a new business is not something that is guaranteed. If you're starting up a new idea, or you have to really put your life on the line here. You're not sure of what the outcome is going to be like. As a food producer, you are being monitored by so many different government bodies. Sometimes it's up to 12 or 14 different bodies that come and check on you and monitor, whether it's health or security, safety, labor. And this has been very, very difficult. For example, we had a problem sometimes with the olive oil. It goes on the market, and we have the expiry date printed on the bottle. And if the expiry date, for instance, is not extremely clear, if there's one letter that is missing or one number that is missing, it is a lawsuit of 10,000 pounds, Egyptian pounds, and 1 year in prison. So if you're in this kind of situation, you really don't want to create a new product or a new idea that might cause even more trouble.
Wadi Foods and Wadi Holdings has been very fortunate and very successful over the last 30 or so years. What are some current challenges that the company faces?
The most challenging situation obstacle that we're facing right now is actually global warming. over the past 3 years, we've seen warmer weather in the winter. And this warmer weather is affecting the olive crop directly. It's too warm in the winter for the olive trees to go through what they call vernalization. It's the induction of blooming of or production of flowers in the olive trees. I monitor the temperatures of the farm on a daily basis, and I can tell you that the temperatures are 4 or 5 degrees Celsius higher than normal. So this is affecting the production of olives, the raw material that we need for our industry, not only for us, of course, but for the whole for all of Egypt. So we are trying to solve this by moving northward. We have a developed land now that is closer to Alexandria because our farms are closer. The original farms are closer to Cairo, so our new farm is closer to Alexandria, where the weather is more or less more Mediterranean and maybe cooler in the winter.
Are you trying to innovate in any of the other ways? Like, do you put the olives under tents or to keep them shaded or?
It's funny you ask that because this was the first year we tried something new like that. We cannot really put them under tents because you need the lights to grow the olive trees. But we have installed micro sprinklers over the trees, and we try to cool down the temperature around the trees just before sunset. And it's bringing the temperature down 3, 4, 5 degrees, maybe just enough for flower induction. And I have to say we've had some success, not full success, but some success with some varieties of olives.
You're an expert in olives. Tell me something about olives that I might not know.
Sometimes people ask the question, is the black olive the same as the green olive? The black olive is originally definitely green. All the olives start green and then they turn into black, natural black on the tree. Some olives are harvested green and then oxidized. It's a processing method that was developed in California and in Spain to take the green olives, to oxidize them with air, and then to pack them or slice them and pit them and whatever way you want to prepare them for the pizza industry or for the regular table olive industry. They don't taste the way the olives, natural olives taste. And sometimes people don't know the difference because this is all they find on their pizzas. They don't know that this is not a natural black olive.
Why oxidize the olive? Why not just wait a little longer for it to turn black? Because it is just a waiting game, right?
Yes. Natural black olives in general are, number one, more expensive and a little softer in the flesh. So if you pit them and slice them, you might end up with a softer sliced olive. If you start with green olives, the flesh is much firmer. And when you oxidize and slice and pit and do whatever you want to do with these olives, then when you put them on the pizza and put the pizza in the oven, the sliced olive comes out quite in one shape. You know, it's not very well very deformed by the time it gets out of the oven. I don't like oxidized olives personally. It's a big market. Most pizza companies, all the pizza chains, use oxidized olives.
Let's talk about the olive itself. Can you just walk me through very briefly the process of going from olive branch to olive oil?
Okay. Now, because we're in the desert, the biggest challenge that we have in the desert is water. In our case, we had to dig very, very deep wells. We had to go 300 meters, that's about 900 feet deep, to have a good well to tap from the water aquifer. So once this is done, then we lay the irrigation system. Then you have to buy the nursery stock, the plants. But now we have our own nursery, so we produce our own stock of trees. And this was also a very big challenge because sometimes we planted trees which were not really the varieties that we wanted to grow from the beginning to start with.
Right.
So we ended up with different, but you cannot tell until the olive tree starts carrying fruits. So it might take 4 or 5 years before you figure that out. And you already, you know, invested so much in the olive tree. Before you plant them, because it's also desert land, It's very, very poor. It doesn't have any nutrients in it. So you have to add compost. You mix that with the soil, and then you plant the seedling on top of that. And you irrigate, and you just hope for the best. The tree grows. After we're getting crops after 3 to 4 years from these olive trees. The olives in Egypt so far are all harvested by hand. The advantage of harvesting manually is the quality of the olives is much higher. Harvesting is a technique or an art in olive production.
Wadi Foods is the first company of its kind to really offer high-quality natural foods at affordable prices to the Egyptian market. When did you start to venture out to the region and internationally?
I think it took us about 3 or 4 years before we started exporting because we didn't have enough production. We were still very young in our production. And we found that the Egyptian market was consuming whatever we were producing. But within 3 or 4 years, our agricultural production was higher than the processing or than the sales of processed products. So we started looking for other markets. Mainly at the time was Europe. We were exporting to Europe.
In addition to selling your products in Egypt and across the region and in Europe, you also sell the products in the United States. When did that first happen and how did that happen?
When we first started exporting, we started exporting in big drums, in bulk. Our olives and olive oil was all sold in big drums. But very quickly, we realized that our clients, European clients, either from Italy or from Spain or Greece, were buying our products, repacking it in smaller containers and selling them to supermarkets in the United States. So we thought, why not do it ourselves. So we started coming and visiting food shows in the United States, and the main one is the Fancy Food Show, and presenting our products to the distributors here and developing packaging for the United States. And very quickly, we realized that this was the right way to go.
Where can Americans find your product?
So far, all our products are private label. So you cannot find a Wadi Food product, but it would be easy to figure out if it's our product. If you look at the label and it says product of Egypt, of a brand that you like, it's probably ours.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Khalil Nasrallah, co-founder of Wadi Foods, a natural foods company located in Egypt. Coming up, we'll meet Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Reed. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Reed, an organization that promotes literacy in India. Planet Reed adds subtitling to songs on TV programs in the same language as the audio so people can read the words as they are sung. Same language subtitling, or SLS, first appeared in 1999 in the Indian state of Gujarat on a 30-minute program of film songs, and now the service is available to 300 million viewers on a weekly basis. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off with your personal history. You grew up in a town on the southern eastern coast of India called Pondicherry. There's an ashram in the center of the town. What role did the ashram play in your life?
Typically, when you think of an ashram in India, you think of people meditating, doing yoga, on a totally spiritual journey. But the Aurobindo Ashram is also very unusual in the sense that actually it emphasizes a lot of sports. So physical education is very important. The other interesting thing about the Aurobindo Ashram was that there are no exams in the schools. So I went from kindergarten till college in one sweep without ever having taken a single exam.
How is your knowledge tested without an exam?
So the system there is that the classes are extremely small. So you might have about 5 to 10 students typically in a classroom. And the teacher is able to really look at the progress of each individual student quite personally.
So after graduating from the ashram, you go to the Indian Institute of Technology to get a master's in physics. Do you remember taking your first test?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have to admit that for the first semester, it was really a struggle for me, switching from never having taken an exam to probably the other extreme of competition in India. In fact, the whole first semester was very difficult.
And then you find yourself in Ithaca, New York, of all places. You left India and went to Cornell to study communications. Do you remember your first impressions of the United States?
I do. I remember just being chaperoned by my fellow student, and he took me sort of around campus, showing things around. Everything was fascinating. But what really caught my attention was that he took me down to the basement of his chemistry department and showed me this box and a machine. And he took out some coins, put it in this machine, and then pressed a button, and down came a can of Coke. And I remember that was so fascinating to me that actually you could get a can of Coke just by, I mean, not even talking to a person.
And do you remember the feeling of cold in Ithaca? I mean, you grew up in Pondicherry where it's like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What was it like to feel Ithaca winters?
I remember the first time I saw snow. In fact, I was 23 years old and it snowed and we were all in a classroom. And all of the Indian students left the room, literally, and the professor was wondering what's going on. Mm. And then I also remember when it was really cold, actually I had already started to sport a beard, so my breath would actually freeze on the beard, and it was like icicles on the beard. So I remember that as well.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. Bridge, the first time you began to focus on literary issues was, ironically, not in India, but in Ecuador while you were a student at Cornell. How did you first come into contact with those literacy issues in Ecuador?
The project that I did in Ecuador was to actually document the knowledge of medicinal plants of 7 indigenous communities there in the Andes. The issue that we were really concerned was that people were losing their knowledge. The issue of literacy came to the fore then because we realized that even after documenting the knowledge in a written form, it was still not accessible to most people in those communities. So we decided that we would actually represent that written text of the book that we ended up publishing in an iconic form. So every plant remedy and how it was actually used was represented visually. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we found out that even children were able to make, you know, sense of what we had put down in print.
Incidentally, you were trying to prevent the disappearance of this knowledge of medicinal plants. Was there any resonance for you because you had studied Ayurvedic medicine at all when you were in India?
Yes, my family in particular is extremely oriented towards Ayurveda and natural remedies. My dad actually eats aloe vera, and he's convinced me to eat aloe vera. And so there are so many things that I just grew up doing at home that were mostly, you know, in the generally the naturopathic realm. So that definitely had an influence. But I think what really influenced me to take this conservation of knowledge issue in Ecuador was really the politics of knowledge, because a lot of knowledge is actually extracted from indigenous communities, and that ends up being somewhere else and some other people benefit from it. So our goal was that how can we conserve the knowledge for the people and with the people?
And then how did this interest in knowledge and literacy translate to this idea for same language subtitling, or SLS?
So I spent about 2 years in Ecuador doing this conservation of knowledge, and then I went back to Ithaca to write my dissertation. And typically what you do when you write your dissertation is actually you watch movies to just, you know, procrastinate, really. And so we were 5 or 6 of us just sitting in a room watching Spanish films. And this one in particular happened to be Pedro Almodovar's The Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, hilarious movie. And we were watching this film, and it was in the subtitles were in English. So the audio was in Spanish. And at that, I just made a casual comment that why don't they just put Spanish subtitles on a Spanish film? And that way we would be able to learn Spanish more. And that's what, that was our goal at that moment. And actually, if they just put Hindi subtitles on Bollywood film songs, maybe India would become literate. And it was more like a casual comment. I said, well, let me try it out as a research project. And that's how the whole thing started.
It's ironic that you had to be in Ecuador in order to come up with this idea. I guess you're feeling illiterate and you're feeling the need to learn Spanish caused the issue to become more personal in a way.
Right. I totally agree with that. Actually, my interest in learning Spanish had become very, very strong. In fact, to a point where I was a little bit insane, perhaps, to actually label everything at home in Spanish. So everybody, my roommates were like a little irritated that whenever they picked up a knife, it said cuchillo on it. So,
by the way, you grew up in a very literate, well-educated family, but in India, 35% of the population is considered illiterate. So what was your exposure to illiteracy in India when you were growing up?
My mom actually became literate much later in life as an adult. And so I could see shades of literacy even within my family. My dad was totally literate. My mom was semi-literate. Illiteracy was all around us in a way. So there was always this sense that illiteracy is a major issue in India.
And when we say the literacy rate is, we should translate to 65%, how is literacy measured? Is that 65% accurate?
It's not a very accurate measure. What typically they do is a census operator actually shows up to a home in a village and would ask a family to list down all the names and then mark each person on whether they're literate or not based on what one individual in the household actually says. So you end up with people who have, let's say, learned a little bit of the alphabet or learned to basically draw their name, not even write their name, just draw their name. They will call themselves literate. Half the people who are thought of as literate by the census are actually what I would call semi-literate.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. So you came back to India in 1996, where you pursue this SLS idea further, this same language subtitling idea further. How did you get it off the ground initially?
What we would do is, take some, tapes of Bollywood film songs and show them at bus stops, in railway stations, in villages, slums. And what we would do is we'd just plop two televisions, one playing the songs without the subtitles and one playing with the same language subtitles. And we'd ask people to just compare the two and see which one they liked. Almost everybody, over, I would say, 90% or 95% of the people we interviewed actually said that they preferred the songs with the subtitles. So what's happening is that people are getting their reading skills practiced as the words get highlighted, and they really don't know that very consciously. They're not aware of it.
Now, you talk about Bollywood films. For those of us in New York or Washington, D.C. or Texas, we might not have had exposure to Bollywood films. What is a Bollywood film?
Oh, if you haven't seen one, please make it a life ambition to see one. I'm a really passionate Bollywood fan myself. Typically, a Bollywood film will have six songs on average, which would mean that they're really musicals. So it's an industry that has just captivated a large section of the world, I would say, not just in India.
Now, when you talk about just plopping these TVs down in railway stations or bus stops, that seems a little strange to me. I think of Grand Central Station in New York. If you just plop a TV down in the middle of the lobby, people would just run away from it, probably. What is the mindset? Are there people just hanging out around the railway stations just watching this stuff?
I think India, in any place, you could actually create a theater and there would be people just congregating there. Any small incident will get a crowd. And we would get easily 100 to 200 people just gather around the television set. So there was just that, people have a lot of time on their hands too.
Because they're not working, perhaps.
Yeah, well, life is slower generally, and they're waiting for a train or they're getting off a train. It's not like they have to, you know, rush off to some meeting or work. You know, pace of life is quite slow for most people.
So you have this casual focus group among these people in the railway stations and the bus stops and the villages. How do you then get it on TV? Your first SLS program was on Gujarat State TV, which is Gujarat is one of the states in India. How did that happen?
So after we were convinced that people in the villages liked this idea, we actually did a proper controlled experiment in a low-income school. And we found that the children in grades 3, 4, and 5 who were exposed to the subtitles, their reading improvement was much faster than the group that was not exposed to the songs with the subtitles. Now, based on that study, we thought, now we have the proof. And when we engaged the director at that point of the television station then, he flatly refused. And his hunch was that this, when you add the subtitles to a song-based program, it'll ruin the program. And so it really became his gut feeling versus our data.
How did you get over that?
What we did is we wrote to all the station directors around the country and asked them if they would try this out on any program. And we would pay for the subtitling, but would they just be willing to allow us to try this out? And nobody responded, except one person who happened to be the director of the All India Radio in Gujarat. And unfortunately, he was not the director of the television station. But 3 months later, this guy who wrote back actually ended up becoming the director of the television station in Gujarat State, a total stroke of luck. And he basically said, try this out on television for 3 episodes only. And if the response is good, we'll see. He got calls from a lot of people saying that, wow, you guys are doing wonderful work for literacy.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a karaoke-like service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. How did you fund the project throughout this time?
So we've tapped into a lot of various sources, and we've kind of had a lot of patchwork funding. But then we really got a big break in 2002. We applied to Development Marketplace. It's a global innovation competition at the World Bank with this idea. And we basically asked for the maximum that they would give, which was about $250,000. And to our surprise, actually, we got it. And that really gave us the, you know, the huge break that we needed to then try and approach national television in Delhi. Of course, even after that, we faced other kinds of hurdles. And I mean, this project has been going on for 11 years now, and there have been so many hurdles. So for example, there was this ridiculous hurdle, I would say, where one of the directors in the national television program wanted actually our equipment, which was about $50,000, $60,000 of editing equipment. He wanted that in exchange for allowing us to subtitle, even though they were not paying for the equipment. But even then, we told those guys that, okay, you can have the equipment, provided you promise that you're going to continue subtitling on a national television program for 5 years. And they couldn't accept that.
Wow, so you almost succumbed to his ridiculous request.
Yeah, actually, it was a kind of a pretty thought-through succumbing, if I can call it that, because what we knew was the life of the equipment is really about 5 years.
In addition to other challenges you faced, you were having difficulty getting FaceTime with the CEO of TV in India, which is kind of analogous to, I guess, the head of the FCC in the United States. How did you get his attention ultimately?
Getting to this person was not easy. So I sent in word that I really wanted to meet him, and he sort of said that he might be able to see me, but wasn't really sure. So I waited about 5-6 hours, literally outside, as I saw, one executive after another just walk by me. And I couldn't get any time with him. But he kind of knew that I was waiting. So finally, he sent word that if I wouldn't mind just taking a ride with him in his car as he went from the television station to his hotel, that was about a 10-minute ride. So I said, great, you know. And then I got into the car with him, I already had my laptop running a Bollywood film song, just turned up the volume and showed it to him. And you won't believe it. He just looked at the idea for literally 15 seconds, didn't say a word, and then said, okay, you come and see me in Delhi, because I think we could actually do something with this. And he became one of the strongest supporters of this idea.
Well, thank God for laptops. Do you worry that there might be some pushback that maybe consumers or viewers want the choice to have these words on the bottom of their screen?
What we did in India is actually did like 3-4 surveys to first find out whether even the literate people actually like this idea or not. And what we found is that the popularity among the literate was over 90%. It was just the entertainment and the karaoke effect of subtitling. On the semi-literate, it was both entertainment and reading practice that they valued. And the illiterates also valued, and their support was about 70%. So people were willing to support it pretty much all across.
Now, Bridge, you live in the San Francisco area in Oakland, yet this project is India-based. How do you split your time?
I pretty much spend half the year in India and half the year in the Bay Area in Oakland. What I focus on is policy pushing in India and also fundraising and relationship building in the United States.
How many children do you have?
I have 3 children, two boys and a girl.
What languages do they speak?
Our children are growing up speaking Hindi, English, of course, and then Portuguese.
Why Portuguese?
So my wife speaks Portuguese and I speak Spanish. And I wanted Spanish, she wanted Portuguese, she won, of course.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.